the backlit maps eliminated the need for flashlight illumination that could give away the presence of a clandestine team, and the small size replaced otherwise bulky sheets of large fold-out terrain maps. Later, TSD lent some of the units to NASA for evaluation as a tool for astronauts to store navigational information when working in darkness during the early spaceflights. Other devices included concealments that would blend into the environment. "I got an idea one day going through one of the stores down in Naha, Okinawa," said Parr. "I noticed the way the thermoses were designed. You could buy a big thermos and a little thermos and switch out the glass insert from the little thermos into the larger body. That gave you a big whopping cavity for concealing papers and documents. It became a standard item for our agents in Vietnam. We put a left-hand thread opening on the bottom so that an unknowing person who attempted to open it would actually make it tighter. Tex then improved on the concept after realizing that dropping the thermos would break the inset and soak any papers inside. By using water-soluble paper, an agent would have a self-destruct mechanism built in his thermos concealment. There was also a new clandestine radio. The RS-6, a portable shortwave radio station, was intended for use by an agent operating behind enemy lines. Transmitting in the 3 to 15 megahertz frequency range at distances up to 3,000 miles, using continuous wave, CW, or Morse code, the RS-6 received both CW and AM signals. The radio was small enough to conceal inside a standard briefcase, or could be separated into four smaller components buried inside waterproof pouches. The versatile set could be powered using storage batteries, AC lines, or a hand-cranked generator. A harassment device known as B3 dust powder consisted of finely powdered tear gas in a small plastic squeeze bottle. Dust powder could harass and disperse groups of people or be used for personal protection. When the non-lethal powder came in contact with the moist tissues of the eyes, nasal passages, or throat, it caused coughing, tears, loss of breath, and nausea. Once the person left the contaminated area, the effects disappeared in a few minutes. A tranquilizer, Puppy Chow, was a plastic case filled with 20 tranquilizer capsules and two sarets containing antidote. The kit was used to silence guard dogs by feeding them tranquilizer capsules mixed with ground beef. The recommended portion for the average dog was 4 capsules, but was to be increased if the animal was particularly ferocious. After ingesting the special mix, the dog became unconscious for up to 4 hours, but suffered no ill effects other than loss of balance and lethargy during the recovery period. If needed, a sarette filled with antidote could be injected to speed up the animal's recovery. A covert document copy attaché kit that contained a complete photographic reproduction system concealed inside a standard briefcase performed the function of a portable photocopier. Once assembled, it offered a one-position copy device for photographing documents up to 9 by 14 inches. The system employed a fixed-focus Pentax camera modified for silent operation. An agent or case officer could use the system to produce properly exposed negatives consistently with no prior training. Early in the Vietnam War, the need to carry adequate food rations posed a persistent problem for covert infiltration teams whose operations could last 90 days or more. Packed in cans with liquid, sea rations, the typical military fare, were bulky and inconvenient. They were heavy, and their metal and paper packaging waste had to be carried out, since any trash would leave evidence of the mission. When I first got to Vietnam, I found the 90-day supply of food, clothing, ammo, and other equipment for one infiltration team took up about 4 pallets, with food rations taking up most of the space, said Jameson. We could airdrop the pallets into remote areas, but for the team to find it and unpack it without leaving a trail was nearly impossible, so I set out to reduce that bulk as much as I could. Working with one of America's leading breakfast cereal companies, TSD engineers thought they found a solution with a product they called CD rations. Resembling today's energy bars, the CD rations contained concentrated servings of protein and other nutrients that were rehydrated in water and cooked in the field to provide all the nutrition of sea rations without the bulk. I had TSD's Asia shop make special survival vests with a lot of pockets of the exact size to carry the new product, remembered Jameson. Then I found a patrol that was going out for several days and was willing to taste test our new rations. They would be gone for a week and subsist only on those rations. We needed to learn how they would be accepted by soldiers under the stress of combat. Jameson accompanied the patrol, which included U.S. Special Forces and 8 Montagnards. No one complained about the food, but the patrol hadn't been out for more than a couple days when some members started getting sick and throwing up the rations, said Jameson. We didn't have any backup food, because I hadn't allowed us to take any. I knew that, given a choice, they probably wouldn't eat what they had left. The team found a village with an orange orchard and loaded up their backpacks. Well, those oranges were extremely acidic, Jameson explained. We ate them like apples, just spitting out the rinds. So by the time we got back to the base camp, the acid was eating the lining of our mouths, and we were all bleeding. We were a sight. It's safe to say future patrols didn't request rations from me. Jameson filed a report on the debacle, and the techs returned to the drawing board with the cereal people. Eventually, that work produced a much better bar, said Jameson, but I could never introduce it, not after the riding I took from those Special Forces guys. Throughout the early part of the war, Stanley Lovell's .22-caliber silenced high-standard pistol was a favorite among CIA and Special Forces. Compact, accurate at close ranges, and reliable, the World War II gun was marking its third decade of service as OTS engineers worked to improve and adapt the weapon to new missions. Among the first enhancements added was an attachable shoulder stock that essentially turned the pistol into a rifle for increased accuracy. Parr, who headed the project, added features to make the pistol suitable for the skies as well as the jungles. After we put the shoulder stock on it, we fitted it with a holster that would survive an enormous amount of G-force, so it became a survival weapon for U-2 pilots, said Parr. That was a cool project. I went to the California test area and sat in the cockpit of an SR-71. I needed to see what it was like if the pilot had to bail out with a holster and weapon on his hip. Same way for the U-2 aircraft. We talked to the pilots. What are your druthers, guys? What makes you uncomfortable? What can you live with? What additional equipment can you handle on top of all the other crap that you've got? We went through all that. Reviewing the high-standard pistol design, TSD engineers discovered that if the sear, the part of the firing mechanism linking the trigger to the hammer, was trimmed down, the weapon functioned as a machine gun, emptying its 10-round magazine in about a second and a half. You'd pull the trigger once, and it would go burp. You'd put 10 rounds into your target, and multiple hitting is always more effective than a single shot, said Parr. But with the silencer on, there was a tendency for the muzzle to drop rather than rise. You'd have to compensate in that direction. With the shoulder stock, you had a degree of control. The whole trick was cutting the sear, and then you had to do a little work making sure the magazine spring was correct. Our goal was a silent machine gun, and we made pretty good progress. During their research, engineers found that silenced weapons frequently malfunctioned and jammed when firing standard military ammunition. For a weapon to be silent as well as lethal, powder loads needed to be precise. Too much powder, and the weapon was noisy. Too little powder, and it suffered in terms of velocity and lethality. That was always trouble with the silent weapons program, using standard-issue ammunition. There was a wide variance in loading consistencies and performance, explained Parr. It turned out the silenced guns just didn't work with regular ammo. TSD engineers also updated the OSS Liberator pistol, the single-shot .45-caliber handgun designed for large-scale distribution to partisan forces behind enemy lines during World War II. The Vietnam edition, called the Deer Gun for Denied Area Weapon, was a small, inexpensive cast aluminum handgun with a blued steel barrel that fired a single 9mm parabellum round. As with the Liberator, it was intended for use by partisans to obtain another, more powerful weapon from the enemy. Packed in a styrofoam box with illustrated instructions, the plan called for an airdrop of the weapons behind enemy lines. By unscrewing the barrel, inserting a single round, and screwing it back together, and cocking it by pulling a plunger like a little kid's toy pistol, the deer would shoot a single 9mm round, explained Parr. Then somebody at headquarters said, "Maybe we're not doing them a favor. Maybe we ought to let them shoot twice." So then we loaded extra rounds in the handle. That created a problem of what to do with the stuck casing after firing. That led to our designing a simple stick, or push rod, to eject the casing, attached to the rubberized butt of the pistol. The question then arose as to the weapon's safety after firing multiple rounds. Would the gun, designed for firing only once, fall apart in the shooter's hand after discharging 5 or 20 rounds? We sent a tech to the range, and he must have shot it 50 times in a row, remembered Parr, but on one shot, he lost control of it and chipped a tooth. After that, people started saying, "Oh, it's a dangerous weapon. People get hurt using it." That spread like wildfire through headquarters, and the plan to airdrop thousands of the guns was scrapped. The High Standard and Liberator were not the only OSS innovations that saw a second life during the Vietnam War. The technical innovations from TSD and other CIA technical offices frequently improved upon the World War II technology with updates that included modern materials and electronics. Among the improved devices adapted to meet 1960s operational requirements was the Stinger, a .22-caliber weapon designed to be fired from the palm of the hand at a person sitting in the same room or passing closely in a crowd. The 1962 update of the original design improved the concealable, reloadable gun that featured a lightweight aluminum firing tube, 4.5 inches long by 3/4 of an inch in diameter. Issued with a spare barrel, 7 rounds of ammunition, and a pictorial instruction sheet, it could be concealed rectally or camouflaged inside a lead-foil tube of mechanics grease inside a toolkit. Another gun, codenamed Goldenrod, concealed a 9mm machine pistol inside an ordinary-looking flashlight. About 1 foot long and 6 inches in diameter, the weapon had an internal circular magazine feed. You loaded all the rounds around the barrel, then pressed the firing button, and this thing would spit out these 9mm rounds at a faster rate than you could distinguish an individual shot, said Parr. You just leveled it toward the target, and it went burp, burp. It stopped when you let your finger up, and started again when you put your finger down. One of the more colorful weapons of the Vietnam era was the gyrojet. The pistol was actually a handheld rocket launcher designed by a California contractor. Constructed of stamped steel and plastic, it fired 13mm projectiles powered by solid rocket fuel that reached a speed of 1,250 feet per second within 60 feet after leaving the barrel. Because the fuel burned quickly, the gun had virtually no recoil and was nearly silent, except for a distinctive whooshing sound. Despite its low noise level, it packed a punch. During one test, the projectile penetrated the door of a 3/4-ton truck and tore through a 55-gallon drum filled with water before embedding itself in the opposite door of the vehicle. Unfortunately, the gun had 2 major flaws— inaccuracy and unreliability. The expended rocket fuel, venting through 2 holes at the base, often sent the projectile off target. It stabilized itself by using miniature canted jets to introduce a spinning rotation along the axis of flight. It would almost spin up in the barrel as it was getting ready to depart, and that was part of its problem, said Parr. You'd pull the trigger, and you'd hear the ignition cartridge fire, and it would sizzle, and then a whoosh. It was like a bottle rocket. It took a little while to build up momentum. It was spinning as it was leaving the barrel. Compared to a firearm, there was a delay. Solving the problem required spending huge sums to machine the mini-jets on each round to precise tolerances. I was managing the gyrojet contract, and the contractor was trying to defend its accuracy, recalled Parr. So he said, "Come on out to our range, and I'll prove it to you." The contractor escorted Parr out to the company range, which consisted of a porch-like affair overlooking a dirt patch. Squeezing off several rounds from the gyrojet, the contractor made shots that clearly were off target. The rounds were all over the map. And the contractor says, "Well, a 45's no more accurate," remembered Parr. He handed me a 45. I fired once and hit right in the middle of the target. Pure luck, but it made my point. TSD discontinued the gyrojet contract because of its accuracy problems, though the gun found limited deployment with SOG. First Lieutenant George Ken Sisler was armed with a gyrojet when he single-handedly charged a North Vietnamese platoon to rescue injured members of his squad. After saving his fellow soldiers, he was shot a short time later by a sniper and awarded the Medal of Honor posthumously. Throughout the Vietnam War, Dien Bien Phu remained a potent reminder of the defeat of the French colonial power. With the North Vietnamese Army, NVA, continuing to use the garrison as a military base, the former French stronghold presented an inviting psychological as well as a military target for some U.S. planners. Headquarters wanted desperately to send a message to the NVA, and we thought we could put together a team with modified 2.75 air-to-ground rockets to attack the target, explained Parr. The idea was to put Dien Bien Phu under siege, at least temporarily, through a covert operation. The techs needed to develop a means to launch rockets into the NVA garrison in rapid fire to simulate artillery, and do it with a single team of a dozen Montagnards. However, to make the system work, the team would have to position the rockets properly and set coordinates because the angle and direction of flight had to be precise for the rockets to strike their targets. We couldn't train Montagnards to use an optical system. It was too complex, said Parr. We had to make it simple. First, the techs calculated the firing angle from the designated launching site to the target, then produced an easy-to-use sighting system. The only requirement was to align a small, free-moving arrow on the rocket casing with a black mark on the bracket that held the rocket in position. Once properly located and with the inclination set, the team could arm the rockets and clear out. Similar to the triple-tube launcher, the rockets had timers that allowed the 12-man team to be far from the area when the attack began. To avoid detection and to deflect attention away from the target, the insertion point was a 3-day walk to Dien Bien Phu. Each of the 12 men carried one modified rocket and locating beacon so the techs could track their progress. After reaching the site, the rockets were positioned, armed, and the team extracted. The rockets fired as programmed and hit their targets inside the garrison. "We all considered the operation a roaring success," said Parr. "We picked up NVA communications stating that the attack came during one of their staff meetings. It was like sticking an elephant with a pin, but remarkably satisfying." By 1968, Laos had become a major battleground as the CIA fought to slow the flow of North Vietnamese troops and material along the Ho Chi Minh Trail that ran through northern and eastern Laos into South Vietnam. The North Vietnamese government protected these routes, in part, by supporting the communist Pathet Lao insurgents who controlled the region. From Udorn, Thailand, the CIA and U.S. military advisors conducted joint operations with Laotians under the leadership of General Vang Pao. The immediate objective was to interdict supplies and men moving on the Ho Chi Minh Trail and retake Pathet Lao-held territory. TSD sent a 4-man survey team into Laos in 1968 to assess the technical requirements needed to support paramilitary operations. The base for CIA containment operations in Laos, near Udorn, was located on the Thai side of the Mekong River that divides Laos and Thailand. In addition to housing the CIA's Joint Liaison Detachment, the base was also home to Air America and a photo interpretation center. The survey established a need for sustained technical support in the area. A technical shop that included an electronics bench, machine shop, photo darkroom, woodworking equipment, and briefing room was constructed. Prominently in the center of the floor sat a brown craft paper-covered work table around which the techs met for operational planning and evaluations. The center table in a workshop without individual offices became a symbol of the cooperation and integration required from all parties in operations planning. TSD techs worked alongside other CIA officers in northern Thailand and Laos, until the U.S. withdrawal from Vietnam. Electronic monitoring of the Ho Chi Minh Trail demanded technical innovation from TSD as the agency attempted to use seismic technology to differentiate the types of vehicles traveling along the trail. To test the prototype devices, we went out to one of our stateside facilities, strung them out on the road, and ran trucks and bicycles by them, Jameson explained. We tested the concept until we figured out how we could do this. I went back to Laos and started burying the detectors alongside the complex of roads and paths that made up the trail. We buried the transceiver off to the side of the road, where they were well camouflaged. As convoys traveled south along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, the devices detected and registered seismic disturbances from traffic and sent the data to a recording unit buried off to the side. Planes then made daily circuits to interrogate the recorders by radio. The Americans also trained indigenous forces to observe at key positions along the trail and report on North Vietnamese convoys. The observers had radios to call in when they saw traffic, but information had value only if the teams understood and reported precisely what they were seeing. Some of them didn't know the difference between a truck or jeep or trailer, Jameson noted. We needed a better way for them to communicate. To compensate for the language problem, the reconnaissance team units were issued the elephant transmitter with buttons that featured icons depicting a man, bicycle, elephant, truck, troop transport, or tank. The observer punched the icon matching the vehicle's shape to record traffic types and numbers. The techs also tapped North Vietnamese communications wherever lines or transmissions were accessible. One program tapped transmission wires, recorded conversations, and transmitted to a hidden repeater that was actually the first of a string of relays that stretched across Laos to a safe listening post in Thailand. In essence, the system functioned like a modern cell phone network, with the signal bouncing from one cell, or repeater, to another, until reaching the listening post. The biggest problem with this operation wasn't the transmission, explained Jameson. It was finding places to hide the relays. The tapping equipment used a mixture of commercial and agency audio devices and batteries reconfigured in the field for the operation. Some of those were concealed in wooden telephone poles. In a typical operation, a two-man team of Montagnards would be inserted by helicopter to within walking distance of the target. It was, at best, a difficult operation, the team carrying a pole filled with batteries and transmitters through miles of hostile territory. Once at the target, they climbed the pole, tied down the telephone line, substituted the original pole with the TSD replacement, and reattached the line. When an operation went smoothly, the listening post immediately received a stream of North Vietnamese conversation. We were getting an awful lot of intelligence on the movement of supply trains coming down along the Ho Chi Minh Trail from North Vietnam to the south, said Jameson. That information allowed us to target supply convoys and understand something of their order of battle plan in the south. Trucks loaded with 7.2 rifle ammo, compared to truckloads of mortar rounds, indicated preparations for different types of engagements. The development of electronic and high-frequency signal and homing devices for clandestine operations may have been TSD's most significant contribution of the Vietnam and Laotian conflicts. Historically, fires lit on top of high places and hilltops served as beacons for navigation and pathfinding and alerts of approaching enemy forces. Paul Revere's midnight ride that warned patriots of the advancing British army began with a beacon of light in a church steeple. By the 1960s, ground-based radio direction-finding equipment became a primary navigation aid to mark a position for guiding aircraft or a ground party to a specific location. The techs installed hundreds of HRT-2C aircraft beacons at defensive and logistic sites throughout Laos to enable pilots to find locations for airdrops, landings, or close support. Although the HRT-2C was compatible with automatic direction finder systems already incorporated into all CIA, military, and commercial aircraft, it presented problems in placement and maintenance. Because each beacon required an antenna at least 14 feet tall with a ground plane and grounding wires, finding a suitable location for placement could be difficult. The wires were vulnerable to people or animal traffic, and sections of the antenna's fiberglass pole were pilfered by villagers who discovered they made excellent pipes for opium smoking. Despite these problems, ground navigation beacons guided pilots throughout Laos and enabled flights in most weather conditions. Agents and reconnaissance teams were equipped with handheld receiver transmitters for positioning, authentication, identifying resupply sites, marking targets, airstrikes, and calling for extraction. The small cylindrical-shaped unit, resembling a swagger stick when extended, featured a collapsible antenna at one end and a push-to-transmit button on the other. To support teams on extended missions in Pathlet Lao-controlled territory or North Vietnam, resupply pallets of food and equipment were airdropped, but the covert operations precluded radio communications with pilots. An alternate means of locating the pallets was required. The answer came in a new type of beacon in the form of portable commercial FM receivers and handheld direction-finding units. The receivers would detect signals from high-frequency transmitters attached to the pallets that began signaling only after the pallet landed. Some airstrike operations involved concealing small transmitters in U.S. radios or rifle butts intentionally left at the scene of a firefight with the expectation they would be scavenged by enemy forces. When these were carried back to a base camp, signals from the bugged weapon would silently pinpoint the location for a precision air attack. Counting all the reconnaissance, resupply, and sabotage operations, I estimated TSD equipment was used in 30 to 40 missions a day in Laos and Vietnam, said Jameson. The technology we used there wasn't particularly advanced compared to what was available for top-of-the-line audio bugs. From our perspective, it seemed that headquarters was more focused on building new audio devices. However, we had guys with enough technical talent that we could build our own bombing beacons. One of these, called the HRT-10, was about the size of a transistor radio with only enough battery life for a few hours. The unit could be concealed in items such as backpacks or PRC-25 radios and issued to agents who infiltrated the Pathlet Lao or North Vietnamese base camps. They'd get up close to the camp and stop to take a crap and hang the antenna on a tree, Jameson explained. Then the agent would come back and tell us where he put it. For instance, it could be 50 yards north-northeast of a base camp in a certain area. Our aircraft could pick up the weak signal once they were in the general area and strafe or bomb the target. Jameson never believed TSD invested sufficient money and effort in developing and upgrading combat support receivers and transmitters. We ended up using commercial receivers and made the modifications ourselves, he recalled. Eventually, a receiver was modified for our aircraft and linked to direction-finding antennas on its belly. It helped, but it was limited to left and right indicators and was so complicated that it required a tech to operate it. We flew in unarmed Air America aircraft to guide the pilot to the target site. The CIA pilots would then call in the Air Force for a bombing raid based on the coordinates. Because the planes could not fly directly over the target without alerting the enemy below, TSD developed a number of techniques for offset targeting. As the spotter plane flew along the side of the target, a tech took readings from the signal, then calculated the target's true coordinates. That information was relayed to the bombers already coming into the operational area. The spotter's planes then released a smoke grenade to provide a visual confirmation of the target for the attack pilots. In the next evolution of the system, a smoke grenade and time delay mechanism were incorporated into the beacon itself. Since the delay did not ignite the smoke grenade until attack aircraft were on station, the procedure reduced the time enemy forces had to scatter or disable the smoke grenade. The most successful operations were ones in which the agent carried a beacon into an enemy camp with the time delay. Walking sticks were common throughout the region and were large enough to conceal beacons and batteries. We devised the means for a timer to switch on so that the asset could depart the area before the signal came on, said Parr. The Air Force then did mini arc light strikes with phantom jets coming in wingtip to wingtip at dawn, flying directly in on one of our signals. Exfiltration of downed pilots and imprisoned soldiers from behind enemy lines was a CIA and military priority throughout the Vietnam War.